Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and it is day four of the RTE scandal and the third day that practically all the papers are leading with it. The Sunday Times has as close as we've heard so far to the question of what happened and who did what, and I think it is probably a particular version of events, but revealed how RTE channelled undeclared money to Tuberty, and we'll come back to that shortly. The Business Post is saying that Tuberty's future at RTE in doubt as agents dealing under scrutiny. The Sunday Independent is saying RTE scandal, Tuberty's cash, quotes, tip of the iceberg. And this is a source from the advertising industry. And that's more about the background of this kind of thing in the industry. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Public Fury, said, look, they have done a poll. It suggests 7 in 10 people say RTE can't regain their trust, which seems a bit extreme. And 75% say Ryan Tuberty should have corrected the public record himself. And 91% say RTE chiefs must now reveal what Keelty is being paid. That's in a poll obviously done very quickly by them. The Sun on Sunday then, you know, when the tabloids have a foreign news story on the cover that it's exciting stuff. So the Sun on Sunday is leading with Putin at the brink. And the Mirror is leading with the Christie we knew and loved. Bandmates tell the Irish Sunday Mirror of their pain at Christie Dignam's death. And then the Sunday World is leading with Aaron Brady on a day out from prison, where he is, of course, serving a life sentence for the murder of Garda Adrian Donoghue. Now, our panel this morning, Aaron Rogan is deputy editor at the Business Post. Bridget Laffin is an emeritus professor at the European University Institute. Andrea Martin is a media lawyer and chair of refugee support group Friends of Ascend, and she is also formerly of the legal department in RTE. Kate Shanahan is a journalist, author, former head of journalism at TU Dublin, and she is also a former RTE radio producer.
And television and, via the independent sector.
Okay. So good morning, everybody, and you're very welcome. Now, I think, Andrea Martin, you might be best placed to explain to us what the Sunday Times is saying, how these payments to Ryan Tuberty from RTE worked.
Maybe best placed because of my media experience, but before this, I did not know what a barter account was. I have no knowledge about the functioning of barter accounts. Okay. I will attempt, perhaps with the help of
Can
my
I
colleagues.
Ask you, Andrea, would you have dealt with contracts here in RTE?
I did deal in contracts. It was over 80 years. 20 years ago. I'm not that old. Yeah. Over 20 years ago. Okay. I have been out of RTE for 17 years now.
Okay.
And I hasten to say that I very much enjoyed my years with RTE and have maintained a good relationship with my former colleagues, many of whom are now retired.
Okay.
So what I say here is based not on any insider knowledge from having worked in RTE. It's based, like everybody else, on what we're reading in today's newspapers and have been reading over the last few days. So what the Sunday Times really is the newspaper with the most detail on how these payments were made. And it states that a brokerage company, a barter brokerage company called Astus in the UK was used. From what I can gather, a barter account appears to be an account whereby there's an exchange of goods and services, but they're done through a broker. So effectively, we will supply a particular individual. It was probably in this case Ryan Tuberty, and in return we'll give you on-air exposure.
Yeah.
You pay Ryan Tuberty a certain amount, he will do a certain amount for you, and we'll give you some on-air exposure.
Yeah, I think possibly in this case, I looked up the Astis Media website, if I'll just interrupt you for a second, right? And it I think this maybe possibly does explain something. So Astis Group enables advertisers to use their product or service to enhance their media budgets. Now, they say here the process is risk-free for our clients and 100% accountable. That might be a bit optimistic in this case. We enable our media partners, they say, to offset some of their hard cash costs to their business and bring them clients which complement their channels. So I think this is the most telling sentence. We enable media owners to trade their soft currency, media space, for goods and services they need. So is the suggestion here that this crowd asked us, gave RTE cash through Ryan Tuberty in return for RTE giving them soft currency of advertising.
Not directly to Astis, but directly to one of Astis's clients.
Yes, okay. So this is very much suggesting that in this story that RTE suggested that this is how it would be done.
This was certainly a mechanism that would ultimately need to have been set up and approved within RTE. Whoever came up with the idea, I don't know, but it may well have been RTE. My own view in this entire matter is that nobody said no. There were so many opportunities for somebody to say, no, we may really, really, really need Ryan Tuberty's services, but not at any price, and didn't say no. Noel Kelly, I was wondering how long it would take for Noel Kelly's name to come out in this debate, because he's obviously a key player. He is Ryan Tuberty's agent, an agent for a number of RT personalities. But an agent does the best for his client. It's up to the person he's negotiating with to say, thus far and no further, there's a limit to how much we're going to pay, which is, in my view, what should have happened in this case, rather than trying to find back channel ways of making a payment. Just say no.
Yeah, okay. Aaron Rogan, ye have different aspects of this story in the Business Post today.
Although Noel Kelly is central to that as well, that there seems to be a growing concern about Ryan Tuberty's credibility as a broadcaster and how he can hold people to account and get involved in the issues of
the
day.
Where is that when you say a growing
That's coming from within RTE. Okay. We're speaking to different people. The Sunday Independent have people saying that they would refuse to work with them again. Now, this is all in the heat of the opening of a controversy. These things fade and recede and people sort of get on with their work and their lives. But it does seem to me that across all the papers this morning, RTE is badly damaged as a brand, both with government, but also with its viewership and listenership. Alison O'Connor has a piece in the Sunday Times where she's saying that the work to build up public trust during COVID has now been destroyed. That work was built up through journalism, through explaining difficult situations with people. And this has been destroyed by a relatively small commercial deal. That gives a sense of an organisation that's not really valuing its most valuable assets properly, which is its journalism and its trust. Ian Guider makes a point in the Business Post that there's zero chance now of funding being addressed. I think that's been borne out by the pausing of the reform of the licence fee and the future funding of broadcasting, which is quite damaging. Dee Forbes' entire stint as Director General was making the point that there needs to be radical reform of funding for public service broadcasting in a time of misinformation and disinformation. And now she will end her tenure suspended and with the reputation of RTE badly damaged.
Okay, and we did ask Dee Forbes to talk to us this morning, but she is unavailable and she is not commenting at this time. Kate, it's interesting what Aaron says, that the credibility of the whole organisation so damaged by something that has nothing to do with the vast majority. I think everyone has agreed in the last week that the vast majority of people working in this organisation have nothing to do with this, are not part of this kind of culture, and have been, I think a lot of people have commented that many of the journalists in here have been fairly have been really driving this story in lots of ways and have been asking the hard questions and everything. Is it fair that all these people are being damaged by this kind of what people seem to agree is grubby carry-on in one part of the one aspect of the organisation?
It isn't fair, but it's very understandable. And I think there's great kudos due both to the journalists and presenters and everybody who's worked on the story this week, because having worked in other media organisations, it's very hard to put your hands up when you're in a breaking story and it's about you and blame yourself, because you're going to have loads of different pressures around the story, personal relationships, for example, fears around your own position. I mean, that's quite, normal as well. So I think they've done a great job in doing the story this week. I think Shuni Raleigh was obviously thrown in at the deep end. The fact that she came on air was hugely important in the initial day or two. The fact that RTÉ issued
a board, which, as people have been pains to point out, and it's worth saying it again, there is a board which oversees RTÉ kind of on behalf of the government. There is an executive board which runs RTÉ of senior management, and a lot of people felt they were late at coming out on this.
Yeah, the leadership was shown by the board, and that was quite significant as well. And that may be because of the interregnum between the appointment of a new director general. I'd say headless chickens wouldn't have been in it this week, because it's obvious.
They've had three months,
but I'm looking at some of the information coming out this morning. When this emerged in the first place and somebody started asking questions, it took quite a long time for RTÉ itself, and they still, I mean, you're learning more from the newspapers than we've had from any statements from RTÉ. They obviously weren't quite sure how this operated. Now, part of, I presume, their reticence, and probably Andrea will point this out as well, is everybody, as I think it was the Sunday Business Post has said, everybody has lawyered up this morning. So people
the due process due and process people have their rights.
Even though everybody's angry, I'm angering myself about it, you are conscious that you have to be fair and proportionate in dealing with this, because there's named individuals that you're dealing with.
Yeah, it does leave you on the back foot, though, interrupt you there, Kate, and say it leaves you on the back foot when some people are clearly going to the Sunday Times and telling them their version of events.
Absolutely,
RTÉ seems unable to give their side of the story, because it could be the whole story, but it's very much one side of the story.
It
dumps it firmly in RTÉ's camp. We have looked for RTÉ this morning to respond to this story, and
just
they're
on that
nobody
point,
available.
On Wednesday, we put questions, and as did other media organisations, put questions to the outside communications company used by the RTÉ board, asking if Dee Forbes was still in place. And we were told that she was on annual leave. Then on Thursday, a statement comes out saying that she's actually been suspended since Wednesday. There's no formal announcement of Adrian Lynch's appointment as Deputy Director General.
It was a line in the original statement on Thursday from the chairperson of the board.
Yeah.
It was actually in that.
Yeah. And it's, we had to ask that he's now acting as Director General at that stage. Like, there should have been a much more open and transparent process, given that all of this has come about from a lack of transparency. And I don't think that's been the case.
Okay. Bridget.
So I think I would say two things. Firstly, that RTÉ relies obviously on the public purse in terms of the licence fee, but that's not enough for it to function as a public sector broadcaster. So the commercial element. And there is a tension there between the public sector remit and the fact that RTÉ has to be a commercial player. And it strikes me that a lot of the governance issues were around the relationship between the commercial side of the organisation and the broadcasting. And when it comes to the commercial side, I still don't know, is the only broker that company out there, or was there a budget internally, a broker budget. Under whose command was it? Was it the commercial side? Did the audit committee of the board have oversight of it? Did the RTE finance department have?
It seems that these kind of contra deals, as I think these are often called, were off balance sheet until recently. Andrea, would that be your understanding?
That's certainly the understanding that I would have from everything I've read, that there hasn't been finance committee oversight of the management of this account. I have a degree of sympathy with RTE's position in terms of what you said about not being able to say anything. But this isn't just involved one or two people. This is a very complex, perfect storm of who knew what. Mm-hmm. There may have been yet another example of groupthink, of thinking, this is okay because we've done it for years.
I wonder if there is. Bridget said there about the tensions between commercial and
valid
public
point.
Service. I wonder, are we? And I believe this government review is going to look at the culture in RTE. Is there a different culture in the commercial and advertising sector that possibly clashes with a kind of a public service culture?
There most certainly is. And then the question internally in an organisation like RTE, there must be oversight in the management committee and then oversight by the board. And the problem is, if you don't have transparency, you don't know what's happening in your institution.
So you can understand that people might have wanted Chinese walls as well between aspects of things.
But I mean, reading about consultancy invoices for something that was clearly not consultancy. So in other words, it's more an interrogation of the practices and then... Yeah. A level of transparency, because there is, of course, always, you know, there's no perfect organisation in this world. But I think that this goes to the heart of some serious governance issues and will have to now be looked at, I would say, root and branch.
Okay.
There's a practical question, I suppose, that everybody's asking. Like the ordinary people I've spoken to over the past few days who never worked in RTE, but they would say, if you have a salary, and your salary's 400 plus thousand, and then you're getting 75,000, and that is because of sponsorship. Why do you get that? And people were asking me, why would you get this extra money? Why wasn't it all just your salary? Like, what was the reasoning behind it? Because there must have been some reasoning behind it. Now, you could look at it conspiratorially, or you could look at, I know from dealing in the independent sector, where I would have been across salaries and people, you know, coming in and making arguments. One of the arguments someone would make if you had a current affairs quotient in it is, I can't do X or Y ads anymore. I can't do this anymore because I might be called to account because I have a relationship with this person if they're the sponsor of the programme. Therefore, you know, I'm going to lose money. So you need to balance that by giving me extra money. So one presenter, for example, I always remembered, looked for an extra 30,000 based on that's how much this person would lose.
Because there was an opportunity cost to them.
Opportunity cost to them. Losing other work and their brand now being completely associated with this particular brand. So they said in terms of personal appearance, they would lose this. I then went and rang a PR agency and I found out the exact amount of money that this person would be paid, because they all know what they would give somebody for an appearance. And I was able to go back and say to my then boss, well, actually, it's probably about more like 5,000 is what the person would lose because of this, because they're not in that bracket. But that's the kind of dealing that goes on sometimes. So when you were wondering...
Is it appropriate in a public service broadcaster for that kind of dealing?
Everybody's going to look for more money, Brendan. That's the whole thing. But what I still can't understand, and I think that's the nub of the problem, is you got a salary. What is the extra money for? And I would say in my, you know, from dealing with presenters, it's at the end of the day, it's how much an organisation is willing to give to a presenter to hold them because they're afraid they might go elsewhere. Ireland is a small country. The wages were artificially inflated for years. RTE said, right, this has to stop. We're cutting the wages back. And then we're now cutting the wages of our staff back because we're in serious financial difficulties. And on top of that, we're asking all of you guys who are out front to take 15% because the general public are up in arms about the wages you're paying. So that was all very clear. So the reason for any extra payment, I still don't understand that.
Yeah, okay. Just before I go to you, Bridget, I just want to say that we did also look for both Ryan Tuberty and Noel Kelly this morning, and they did not get back to us. And I should say, it does say in this Sunday Times piece that the London barter firm involved acted in good faith at all times, and there is no suggestion of any wrongdoing on its part or on the part of either Kelly or Tuberty. So, Bridget, sorry.
I think the other thing, though, we should emphasise, because I am very struck by that 75% wouldn't trust RTE, because I think, regardless of the information coming from RTE qua institution, I think both the editorial teams and the journalists have handled this really impeccably. They haven't hidden from it. It's been main 9 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news. Most of, like today, we're having a discussion of it. So if the core business of RTE is being a public sector broadcaster, it's still doing that core business.
Okay, so I think we need to... Should we, and so I think that's a very good point, Bridget. Should we be very clear that whatever government-sponsored review is happening in here to culture and everything, it's about the management and the corporate governance, that this, we don't have a mission creep into the government starting to look into the culture of broadcasting. Are we agree there?
Absolutely. And can I say, having lived in Italy for 8 years in a country where the broadcasters are in the pay, almost, I'm wrong to say in the pay of the government, but heavily influenced, it's a disaster. So we have to keep the independence of editorial control in our public sector broadcaster.
Okay. There's a text here saying that in order to credibly moderate this discussion, it would be very helpful if you could confirm if me didn't benefit from a barter account from Clare and Dublin. I did, and I have confirmed that to the media also in the last few days. So listen, we have been looking for somebody to tell us about barter, and we have found somebody. So I believe Vivian McKechnie is on the line. Good morning, Vivian.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Good. So you are a partner at PT78 Media Auditing Company. You did also work in the RTE Commercial Department. You were also on the board of the BAI. So presumably you have audited all these kinds of situations. So can you explain to us very clearly and in English first about barter accounts, and can you tell us about Astus, this company in England?
Yeah, so I mean, I think barter is a very common practice in all sorts of industries, you know, where in all sorts of industries, people use barter companies to essentially sell unsold inventory. So Astus specifically specialise in trading with media companies. So essentially how it works is, if you were a TV or a radio station, for example, if you have advertising minutes that aren't sold, let's say, this week, once that airtime is gone, you can't realise any revenue for it. So quite often, you know, what can happen is that can be sold to a barter company, and a barter company trades with, you know, with advertisers. So it's a very, barter in itself is a relatively common practice. And it is a way of just realising that small percentage of unsold inventory for all media owners.
Okay. So a legitimate practice then, and quite widespread?
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, and it would be, I mean, barter is something that it's probably about 10 or so, 15 maybe years old, that media companies would trade with barter companies. Yes, yeah.
Okay. What do you think, as we understand from the Sunday Times today, of how it worked in this situation? Is this common practice, would you think?
Yeah, well, I should say first, Brendan, I haven't seen the Sunday Times article, but I think...
Will I just say in a nutshell, right, it seems that for a top-up of pay for Ryan Tuberty, his manager was told to invoice to Astus through RTE. Astus seemed to have paid the money, as far as I understand it, and RTE then seemed to have a credit to Astus for that money plus 80 grand.
Yeah. So, look, you know, and I think there needs to be an explanation of why it was done in that way. I mean, the only explanation that I can think of is, you know, if it's in relation to a payment from an advertiser and not from RTE, which, as I understand, was one of the explanations given earlier in the week, that advertiser may have had advertising credits with, but I don't know that. You know, I'm speculating.
But so
I don't know why the payment would have gone through a barter account. It may have been in relation to, you know, advertising, you know, their system of payments. But I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
And it certainly wouldn't be you know, either Ian Tuberty or Noel Kelly who would have credits with Astis necessarily. That, you know, that's, it's probably really more related to an advertiser.
Yeah, but would it be unusual for someone to be paid by paid cash through Astis?
It would be very unusual for a presenter. But certainly you know, Astis do also you know, you can buy out credits in cash payments. So both media companies and advertisers and companies in all sorts of industries can buy out their credits and be paid cash.
Yeah.
So that's relatively common practice as well. But for a presenter, I can't answer that.
Okay. I think that's says enough. Okay, Vivian McKechnie, a partner at PT78 Media Auditing Company. Thank you very much for taking that call at short notice. By the way, sorry, I might not have been clear there. Another texter said, Brendan, you didn't make it clear in your statement there. Did you or did you not benefit from a barter account? Have you benefited directly or indirectly from any income from RT not disclosed as part of your salary? No, is the answer. I have not. Aaron, you wanted to come in there, did you?
No.
Okay. Right. Is there? It's no. I don't. I'm conscious of not wanting to move on from this. If people feel that there are more points we need to make,
I think one thing I would say, Brendan, and it's something I probably noticed myself, is that there was a cultural shift within RTÉ in probably around the 2000, and that shift was around both how presenters were treated, how staff salaries were looked at, and the relationship between the two.
Okay.
And you know, that was an important thing, because staff themselves were very discontent when they were seeing people on very high salaries. And you are, in journalism, you are part of a team. But at the same time, you had, in a small country, a sort of a star system. And that created its own difficulty. And talking to one senior executive in RTÉ about this, I asked him why was there so much money paid? And he said, nobody wants to be the one to lose a big star to a rival. And that was part of what was happening. But also, when I started, I did my producer training course, I was told two things, and it was drummed into me. No one is bigger than RTÉ. And the second thing was, you're a servant of the public. And so when you get grief from politicians or from vested interest groups, the one thing you can always use in your own defence is, I'm asking the question that everybody else wants to ask. And that you have that independence, particularly because you're a public service broadcaster. So when that sort of commercial interest thing became very prominent, I noticed, for example, getting calls when I was in the independent sector about items you'd have on a programme that commercial were annoyed over it, because, you know, that's an advertiser, and because you had somebody on that was giving them a free plug. And we immediately said we wouldn't take those kind of calls and would have nothing to do with them, because we were editorial. And what I thought about after was, a couple of years before that, nobody in commercial would have dared contact and made a point like that. So there was obviously a power balance shift had got on within the organisation itself. And probably they would say they were under tremendous pressure, because the organisation was hemorrhaging funds. You've got to remember, in 2020, you know, RTÉ was looking for COVID payments. It was saying 35% down in its income. So there was a lot of other stuff going on in the background. It doesn't justify what happened at all. But editorial people, when they're faced with something like that, you may be right, there may have been a hands-off thing of, you know, the Chinese walls, but you cannot do that in a public service organisation. Public service has to come before commercial at all times.
And Andrea and Bridget, you're both nodding along vigorously there.
I think that what Kate said about not wanting to be the one who loses Ryan Tuberty, nobody wants that on their record. It would seem right up to Dee Forbes. She has said in her statement that at all times she did what she thought was best for RTÉ. Nobody seems to have stood back and looked at, Is it best for RTÉ to be operating in this way? Commercial imperatives have led to poor judgment in the past, and I think this is another occasion where what was seen as commercial imperatives has led to poor judgment. And it's
absolutely heartbreaking. I was driving in here and I said to my partner who was driving me, I said, my God, this is so sad. It feels like, I mean, a family being torn apart by an internal row and total disappointment in each other. It's a heartbreaking thing for RTE,
Could this have all been avoided if they came up with a straight story in the 3 months they've had since this happened and came out and explained what happened?
Because there is no explanation of what has happened that can make it acceptable.
Okay. Bridget, yeah?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there were very significant payments and these were undisclosed. And it's the fact that they were significant, but more importantly, undisclosed.
The Sunday Times was quite clear this morning, and I think it has to be said, that there is no imputation or allegation of wrongdoing on part of either Noel Kelly or Ryan Tuberty. And what they're talking about is that when Noel Kelly went looking for his money, he was told, this is how you get your money.
I think that is our version of events. Let's be clear on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But Aaron, you have to go back to who decided to give this money in the first place.
So that's one version of it. We don't have RTE's version, so we're kind of still
just
probably...
Generally on the point of the increasing commercial balance shift in RTE, I mean, we're seeing it more and more. They have a commercial relationship with the GAA through the GAA Go platform, which, you know, seems to be in conflict with the public service aspect of showing the national games, as they're called. There does seem to be a sense that RT is an increasingly commercial media operator. We feel that in the independent sector a lot. I'm sure the advertising deals done in RTE are done in a way that is very frustrating to other media organisations looking to try and get ads.
Yeah. And I mean, the rest of the media has been banging this drum for a long time, in fairness. And they're not entirely unhappy about this situation developing, I'd say. And who can blame them? I'll read some texts. It's quite likely this whole controversy will boil down to an accounting practice that may well turn out to be completely legal. God, but we have an incredible ability to turn on our own like vultures. That's from Paul. Kieran in Tralee says contracts should be scrapped by RTE and all employees should be employed directly by the broadcaster. I'd say you might get no complaints from a lot of people who are on contracts here. Did RTE have to produce positive content for advertisers without admitting it was an advert to hide the payment scam? No, I don't. There was no suggestion of that whatsoever. I think if anything, they probably gave advertising airtime credit, I think would be what we would understand here. And that, then I think that company, Astis, then sells that to other clients. Brendan, as a bank minion, we suffered from customers and financially with the bank scandal. My salary was nothing like Tubbs, so I can empathise with people's lack of support for RTE. I listen to RTE radio all day, every day, says Moira in Cork. I enjoy the high level of professionalism by all the presenters and journalists. This issue is between Ryan Tuberty and whoever in RTE knew about this deal. I will continue to listen to all the other excellent radio content delivered by professionals like myself. If any more deals come to light with any other presenters, journalists, they will also have to be held accountable, like Ryan, and brokers of this deal should be carry on the great work, Marion Cork. Okay, I didn't know what that said when I started reading it there. I'd only seen the first line. Okay, now...
Make one comment there, Brendan, that it came up there in one of those comments about it'll probably turn out to be completely lawful. There's no suggestion here of anybody doing anything unlawful. It's in a completely different realm. It's about transparency. Now, I'm not a corporate lawyer. I don't know if this kind of using an a barter account in this way might be in breach of some corporate accounting requirements. But I don't think it's not about somebody doing something that's unlawful. It's about letting us down as a nation and lack of transparency.
Okay.
Because the people who went out front and said this was the salaries we were giving to presenters and this was the cut they had taken, they did so believing this was correct information. And I think that's what it comes down to.
We don't know that all of them did.
I don't know if all of them did, but some of them did.
One person must have known at least.
Somebody must have. Well, we don't know yet, you know, on whose head all of this lies. But there was never a sense that the figures being given to the newspapers, and they were very assiduous about seeking those figures, and there was a big drive to get those figures from everybody, the general public and everybody else, that we all believed those were the concrete figures. And, you know, people will argue about any amount of money that you pay anybody, really. But I think there was a belief, well, at least they are taking a cut. Because if you came back to the journalists and the reporters and the other people, the researchers, they were all taking a cut. And a cut of 10% on 40,000 a year is very different to a cut of 10 or 15% on 400,000 a year. And that was taken into account as well. And I think that was important for the staff in a public service organisation, because they do go above and beyond. And I've seen that with friends of mine who still work here, you know, taking calls at the weekend, working late at night, worrying all the time about defamation and worrying about live programmes, you know, not, you know, worrying that you've gotten it right, because the public will tell you immediately when you haven't got it. That's the brilliant thing about live broadcasting. You hear immediately if you've hit the wrong tone or if you've been unfair. But that's something you take to bed and you take it home with you in the evening, that you do worry about.
Yeah.
So there's huge commitments, is what I'm saying, from the people working here.
You're absolutely right. And you know, there are colleagues around here who don't sleep the night before shows up and thinking about stuff, worrying about stuff. It is a thing that people live their vocation in this job. I absolutely think
and
love
right. and feel proud
of
it.
And
you
think that this is not what you're saying is that this untruth, or this, we won't call it a lie, but the economical with the truth about those top 10 salaries, it's not just a by the way small lie. This, you think this economics with the truth was a central message from RTE that was being misrepresented?
It was, because it was hugely important at the time. It was hugely important to the public. And obviously, when the public trust you, people give out about RT like you give out about your parents when you're a teenager. You know, you resent them, but every now and again, you know, they come through for you and they do well. They did well during the pandemic. They did very, very well during the economic crisis and the post-Celtic Tiger analysis. And also, you know, breaking stories, you know, going around the country, you know, taking stories that might not get that amount of attention. And that's really important. At one point, and it struck me when I was reading this, I was incredibly upset by it. I was saying, what is wrong with you? It's, you know, it's nothing to do with you. But it was also part of my history of working here that I was very proud of it. And to see it destroyed, to see this organisation basically being run into the ground by something that the vast majority of people had no awareness of and would have nothing to do with, that's really difficult to take on board. And I think, coming back from what Shane Ross said today, hard decisions must be taken quickly. And I think he's right. I think you have to be fair and you have to be proportionate, but you may have to take hard decisions in this organisation over the coming weeks.
OK, and that needs to happen more quickly than it's been happening, you think. OK, look, I'm reluctant to leave this until everybody has felt they have got to say everything they want to say. But is everybody happy that we have done this exhaustively? OK. All right, we'll take a break. I don't want to be accused of moving on from it or sparing anyone's blushes either. So we'll take a break. So Aaron Rogan, Deputy Editor of the Business Post, Bridget Laffin, Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute, and Andrea Martin, Media Lawyer and Chair of Refugee Support Group Friends of Ascend, are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Aaron Rogan, Bridget Laffin, Andrea Martin and Kate Shanahan are still with us. And look, we'll try and romp through some of the other very important things that are going on in the world. Aaron, Russia has been having an RTE-style moment as well, family tearing itself apart there. So you've picked a piece in the Sunday Times there by Mark Galliotti, but you were writing about it yourself in the front of the Business Post. So bring us up to speed with the drama.
It's slightly higher stakes, I must say, than the RTE, than Montrose. So what has happened is the head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has effectively mutinied and tried to march on Moscow, only to get cold feet at some point. He's now been offered exile and is very likely to have taken it up in Belarus. But the much more important thing is, obviously, it's the day of high drama, and there was bizarre scenes of mutinous soldiers and rebels in coffee shops and towns they had taken back in their own homeland. But the attention now turns to how weak, how damaged Putin is. And Mark Galliotti's piece makes the point that this is the beginning of the end of Putin. and that even though he has successfully stood down or faced up to this attempted insurrection, that it'll be a mortal wound on him. And then there's another piece by Mark Almond, who's a director of the Crisis Research Institute of Oxford, in the Mail on Sunday, making the point that the fate of a vast nuclear arsenal is now in play. If Putin is weakened, if he's damaged, he's likely to react in a very, very violent and destructive way.
Yeah, and so there was a lot of talk last night about keeping an eye on the tactical nuclear weapons, which are kind of the ones, Bridget, that could be used without ending the world, would be the view on them, wouldn't it? Like that.
Yes, but yeah. Of course he can't cross that line, or if he does cross that line, then our world is in terrible, terrible danger.
So, Bridget, is it wishful thinking by all of us to think that that Putin is weakened by this?
Oh, no. He is weakened by it, without any shadow of a doubt. Why is he weakened? Because unlike in the communist system, there was a Politburo, so there were checks and balances. Putin was numero uno. He centralised power, protected himself. And when you have such a heavy concentration of power and they're weakened, and in my view humiliated, because he was, then we're entering very dangerous territory. So what did he lose? Firstly, it highlighted the fact how dangerous it is to have a mercenary armed forces on your territory. They can turn on you. Machiavelli warned of that a very long time ago. He was right then.
Right.
And the same thing holds now. He has less money to throw around to buy people. And he clearly is not entirely in control of the armed forces. And I would add to that, his image was that of the strong man. And all he did yesterday was go on television, make one announcement, say Prigozhin was a traitor, that it was a stab in the back. It was 1917 again, and he should remember what happened, the Tsar then. But then Prigozhin, he does nothing. Prigozhin is getting out. And I don't think it's the end of this. I'm not saying that Prigozhin will come back to Russia, because I think he also needs a lot of security detail around him.
Well, I heard one analyst say last night that if he does go to Belarus, which is where he's being offered sanctuary, and of course, the Belarusians are huge allies of Putin, that he shouldn't go above the first floor of any building.
Or he also, Wagner is very active in Africa. He may end up there, and he's done unspeakable damage in Africa. So I think what we're seeing, we don't know when it ends, and it won't be good. Because
yeah. Does one of them have to die now?
I think Prigozhin is off. He's gone now in terms of the future. But if you're sitting in Moscow today or in Petersburg and you're thinking there's regime change coming sometime, whose side are you going to be on? Will you back Putin to the hilt, or will you start having a plan B? So in other words, there's a lot of people figuring out.
Okay. And this might have emboldened some of that resistance
that we hope is there in the elite in Russia.
Okay.
But can I also say on the war that what this has also exposed is the fact that Putin has failed utterly in Ukraine, utterly, because he couldn't take it. They've taken some territory, but not a lot. They haven't got Kyiv. And so I think we're also probably seeing the beginning of the end of the war as well, because again, how much, if you're in the Russian armed forces and they're losing combatants at the rate they are, both to death and injury, then again, if you're not sure the main man is going to be around forever. So
okay.
I think we're in a very uncertain.
It could have reframed everything. It's
very
uncertain. Okay. Kate, you picked that Mark Galliani.
I did.
And
I suppose one of the things that I think about a lot when I think about Russia is how little we know from inside Russia. And the main reason for that is that we do look at it with Western eyes. We're depending on independent Russian media, most of whom are now operating from outside of Russia, various analysts and military analysts who've proved to be singularly unsuccessful in telling us what's going to happen in the Ukraine war. Mark Galliotti, did not have the benefit of what was happening when he wrote his piece. So fair dues to him, he got it right, that they would come to some sort of an agreement, and it was damaging to Putin, but it was not necessarily the end of him. The one thing I do, we had a group of Russian journalists, young Russian journalists and some older ones come over to Dublin, and they were on a looking at the EU and talking to people in Ireland about Brexit, and you know, they went to the Department of Foreign Affairs, various places. We ended up socialising with them, as you would. And one of the things I found very interesting was how different their view of what was happening internally, this is before the Ukraine war, to what our view was. And your anticipation that all of the young people were going to be quite liberal and quite pro-West wasn't necessarily true. And your belief that the older journalists who would have, you know, covered a lot of the, you know, the wars, the earlier wars like Chechnya, that they would be very pro-Putin equally wasn't true. There was quite a diversity of opinion. And one of the things that struck me about Prigozhin is that the amount of conspiracy theories last night coming from everywhere, from, you know, various analysts from various news websites, that he was actually put up to it by Putin.
That this was to test.
This was the test. And that the idiots who would, you know, make the wrong phone call and say that they might support or might welcome him when he eventually turned up in Moscow, that Putin was trying to see who in his own place was actually willing to turn against him.
I heard a wise old Russian analyst though last night say what I thought was an interesting thing. He said, Western people think in straight lines, right? You do not understand the Russian mind. We think everything is lateral, and sideways and circular. So it could well be that this was some kind of weird plan. Can I bring this closer to home? And Andrea, I know you wanted to come in there, but because we have limited time now, our own neutrality is the conversation around that is being framed by all of this at the moment. You picked a piece in the Business Post today by Lucinda Creighton. Higgins has no legitimacy lecturing the government about peace or neutrality.
Well, she didn't hold back.
She sure didn't.
Lucinda Creighton has absolutely lambasted Michael G. Higgins, questioning his record on his associations with South American dictators. I'm sure she's referring to his relationship many, many years ago with Daniel Ortega, when he welcomed Ortega to Ireland, had a very close relationship with Daniel Ortega. Daniel Ortega has turned from ideologically inspiring revolutionary over the course of 30 years to a brutal dictator, as can happen. I think it would be unfair
He did speak warmly of other...
And Fidel Castro. I think Michael T. is of great benefit to us. He enables us. He doesn't see the world in black and white. I would not... I actually was glad of his intervention. Yes, he is stretching the boundaries of his role. He is open to criticism. But my goodness, has he focused debate? And I think, was it yourself, the chair of the debate, was it yourself as well raised this at the forum?
I think you'll actually find I said it here last week. He certainly got everyone talking about the forum
debate.
and he did.
That he focused debate. And there is a story now, a commentator in the Sunday Times with whom who reflects my own views. Now, who was it? I've got him here. Colin Murphy.
Yeah.
And I agree, yes, we do have a partisan neutrality, but it's better than nothing. And we might have a role to play in saying ostensibly neutral as a go-between. We don't have a lot to bring to the table militarily, but we do have something to bring to the table of international affairs as a go-between, a trusted broker. What I don't agree with is that we need to rely on the UK to protect our shores and our fisheries. That is ridiculous.
Bridget, you obviously spoke
at
this stitch up.
I was one of the maligned academics, and apparently I'd be back in Dublin Castle on next Tuesday for the session defining neutrality, which would be great fun. But can I say that I think we need to... Also, the NATO neutrality binary isn't helpful to us when it comes to what security policy is appropriate for Ireland in the 21st century.
And regardless of our foreign policy in the world outside, we have an obligation as a state to take our own security seriously. And this country is effectively, we're weak on cyber, we're weak when it comes to surveillance of the seabed, we're weak on the...
Can we stay neutral and do all those things?
So in my view, the questions should be, I don't think there's any desire for Ireland to join NATO in the public, or that NATO wants us. So I don't think we should park that and not see every discussion of security as, oh, it's NATO or neutrality. But so for one very good example, NATO is setting up a new centre for the surveillance of the seabed. It will be located in the UK. We're associated with NATO through the Partnership for Peace. Is it in the interests of this country that has territorial waters that are 12 times the size of the country? Do we need to cooperate with that centre?
So you're suggesting a kind of an a la carte Catholicism, if you will, or a la carte neutrality, a la carte membership of NATO, that we take it on as it suits us on various issues to cooperate.
My view is we should, again, back to that awful word called transparency, we should think through what elements of EU security policy we're involved in and what cooperation with NATO. But what we can't do is pretend that we have a security strategy when we don't. Aaron. And so for me, that's where the debate is.
Just, the Business Post has a poll this weekend where we asked people about their support for joining or not NATO. But we also asked them if they support or oppose relying on Britain to help police or patrol our seas and foreign actors. 47% of people support that. 40% of Sinn Féin voters support that.
Okay.
It's quite clear that I think that people want that a la carte approach to security, neutrality, NATO. Let's be part of the EU, but not part of that bit of the EU. Let's be part of the West with our foreign direct investment and our subsea cables and all that, but not that part of it. So there is really a desire for an Irish version of neutrality.
But you see, we'll get away with it because everybody loves the Irish, is it?
Yeah. No, we're just lucky geographically. It's nothing to do with them loving us.
Okay.
I think the problem...
Before we continue, that poll is 1,011 people and it was taken online between the 16th and the 21st of June, correct, Aaron? Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
I think one of the problems people have is they don't feel it's up to an individual government to make as big a decision as this in terms of whether we join some further form of security alliance. And I think the reason so many people were suggesting a citizens' assembly, which having, monitored the citizens' assemblies, I thought they were absolutely brilliant, was that they felt that this was not just about asking the experts to come in. This was about us as a country deciding what we could contribute in the future.
Do we not have experts and citizens involved here?
So it's an open forum. Yeah. Anyone signed up, it was... All of the deliberations were online and the questions were both from the online audience and from the room. And I think the thing about citizens' assemblies is they're very good at answering pretty precise questions. But in this country, we're nowhere close to even having the level of precision about security. We're a society that genuinely doesn't think a lot, whereas contrast that with the Finns. Every Finn understands security. So I think we need a discussion first about the world as it now is. And then I could imagine in the future there could well be a citizens' assembly. But I don't think it's an either or.
Does that sound reasonable to you, Kate?
No, I'd still have gone for the citizens' assembly myself. I think it was a better vehicle. I think if the government was going to try and communicate something, that would allow people some control and the feeling of suspicion that it's a done deal. Because I knew I was coming on here, I had a look at the FT and The Hill and various other, foreign publications to see how they were viewing it. And they were saying, won't be long before Ireland joins NATO, because they saw that the actual holding of this was a preparatory phase to joining some new form of alliance.
Would you agree with that, Aaron?
That doesn't work.
Is that the sense?
I think there is a bit of a clamour growing for a citizens' assembly on this. Let's get a group of people in a room and get them to decide what our policy should be. But as you can see from the poll results, that's not going to be a clear outcome. And I think the view is growing that this was designed with people who want us to be more involved in other alliances.
So, Bridget, should there be a citizens' assembly next?
So I think what I would do is I would wait for the report from the chair.
yeah.
and see what that does. I think that report should go back into the Irish Parliament and then see what happens.
Okay. But guys, we've run out. I'm sorry, Kate, but we have run out of time. But listen, thank you all so much for coming in this morning for that very lively hour. Aaron Rogan, Deputy Editor at the Business Post, Bridget Laffin, Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute, Andrea Martin, Media Lawyer and Chair of Refugee Support Group Friends of Ascend, and Kate Shanahan, Journalist and Author and former Head of Journalism at TU Dublin. Thank you all very much. I have to take a break now before we come to the news.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Just time for a quick text. I am so proud of President Higgins, so grateful we have a president who is not a coward, who is brave and wise enough to speak up for the people. We elected him because of his ideas and his courage. Gosh, look at what the Americans had to endure from their last president. We have in our tradition of seeking peace in this country, a tradition that is special and beautiful. That's from Jay in Rialto. And another texter says, I think the voters demonstrated their preference between Michael D and Lucinda. But listen, if you think Michael D went for it last week, Lucinda Creighton certainly went for it in the Business Post today. All right, at 12 o'clock, let's go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.